Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with healthcare in the real world, and it's on both sides of the exam table. Patients are frustrated because it's hard to find a good doctor, and when we do, they're often harried and more focused on their keyboards than they are us. Doctors are frustrated because we've lost control of the profession. We now are generally employees of big hospitals and systems that treat us like widgets on an assembly line, and our autonomy and professional judgment is questioned all the time. Enter the concept of slow medicine, an homage to the slow food movement, in which food is seasonal, local, prepared lovingly, and thoroughly and sensuously enjoyed rather than wolfed down for mere sustenance. Slow medicine is practiced over time, where clinicians and patients spend time in depth without the whistles and bells of advancing technology. Our bodies are seen as plants needing care rather than as machines that need fixing. My guest today, Victoria Sweet, is a doctor and historian at the University of California at San Francisco. In her highly regarded previous memoir, God's Hotel, she wrote about her life and work at one of the last remaining almshouses, Laguna Honda Hospital in California. Her new book is called Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing, and it's a memoir of her entire journey through the world of medicine, a world that has led to new terms like healthcare instead of medicine, and providers instead of doctors. Sweet is a gifted writer with an eye for beauty and an empathic soul, all too rare in today's workaday world of modern medicine. Doctor and historian Victoria Sweet, author of the just-released memoir Slow Medicine, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Victoria Sweet, welcome to Medical Monday. This book, Slow Medicine, is really, it's a memoir. I liken it more to an odyssey, your odyssey. You had somewhat of an atypical pathway, I think, in the medical profession. Not straight to medical school, not straight to residency, the way so many young people who aspire to become physicians do. What are some of the highlights you could share with me about your atypical journey?
I wasn't a natural-born doctor, so it was an advantage and a disadvantage always. There are no doctors in my family, and I never watched doctor shows. I didn't want to know anything about that, so started out atypical just because it had never occurred to me to be a doc. And in fact, I never really thought about what I was going to do when I grew up, partly because as a woman, as a girl at the time, we didn't have to think about what we did, really. And so after I went to college and I finished college, and then I didn't quite know what to do with myself, so I went traveling and thinking about what I was going to do, and I accidentally ran into, in a bookstore during those travels, I ran into Carl Jung's own memoir, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And when I read that, I was just thrilled. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's just a moving, beautiful, important, and meaningful way he lived his life. I think it was the meaningfulness of the way he lived his life that really struck me. It's like, wow, you can live your life this way? So I decided I wanted to be a Jungian analyst, and that's how I got to medical school. So that, I guess you'd say, was pretty atypical, because I went to medical school because in order to become a Jungian analyst, you had to have a doctorate.
Well,
I was like, I'll go to medical school.
I interview people who are applying to medical school, and I've not had anyone tell me they wanted to be a Jungian analyst nowadays. It doesn't happen too much.
Well, even back then, it was, Jung is definitely a certain flavor. But I read him to this day. I've read him ever since. I have all of his works, and I learned German just so I could read him in German, because I felt like I was probably... He's just remarkable, and he's influenced the way all of us think way more than anybody realizes. But anyway, that's how I got to medical school. And then in medical school, I was surprised because I really liked medicine, and I particularly liked when we were taught the physical exam. I think that was one of those turning points when, in the book, and his real name is Dr. Gurushanti, he was this young, inspiring pulmonologist, and we all showed up at the VA. You've been there, John, and you've been in that situation. You've got your fresh white coat, and I'd never touched a patient before, ever. When we had, our stethoscope and our thalmoscope, and we spent the whole day, and we read DeGowan and DeGowan, and I just thought it was amazing that I could actually diagnose things just by examining a patient. I just fell in love with a physical exam. It has not proved to be an adulterous partner. It has been a very good partner, the physical exam, and I was inspired. And so I ended up doing a year of psychiatry and then realizing that I just didn't like psychiatry. I liked the questions it asked, but I felt that it had no really good answers. You know, why is somebody insane, or what is the meaning? And of course, Jung was very much not part. I was pretty naive also, so I didn't go to a Jungian. I just thought, well, I'll go do a psych residency. And so that first year made me realize I really should just go out and practice medicine and see if I liked it. So that's what I did after that.
So the book, your new book, Slow Medicine, is in some ways a response to all of the correspondence you received about your first book, God's Hotel, which was really your story of Laguna Honda Hospital and your work at that hospital, a Hotel Dieu, as it's known in French, or an almshouse. What were some of the responses that you got or the volume that led you on this journey to write Slow Medicine?
So the response to God's Hotel was just huge. And, you know, I was hoping it would be huge, but I didn't know whether it would be. And it was pretty amazing. And I'm still getting, I mean, thousands of letters. And, you know, I've spoken hundreds and hundreds of places. And those letters and emails and speaking engagements and then the Q&A afterwards with the audience really made me realize that the kind of medicine that I was used to practicing and learned and had grown to love was really becoming something that people weren't familiar with. It was kind of shocking. It was shocking. I was like, oh my God, this healthcare providing commodified computery thingy that's taken its place, is people are starting to not even know what I'm talking about. They still did know, but it was starting to be like a distant memory. And that is really what made me think that I needed to do more of an exposition, more of a presentation of what I meant by telling the stories that showed it to me. I really started to get the feeling that it was going to be lost, and pretty soon it was going to be as, you know, much of a story, a fairy tale as Hildegard in her monastery.
More on that. You mentioned that it seems like the way we train doctors in the current time, that there is something that's definitely lost from the way that you were trained, and yet you've written now this second book, and I anticipate you'll have a great response to this one as well. It's such an interesting book, and I truly enjoyed reading it. Clearly, something's resonating with these audiences. I mean, you've been asked to speak hundreds of times and getting thousands of letters.
Yeah, yeah.
So something in what's lost, people are identifying with what you do. And I'll give you an example. So you mentioned the physical exam and how you know, your very first time touching a patient and going through an exam and the checklist, how I think you spent hours and hours. And I can remember in the sore back from standing at the edge of the bed and, you know, all these things that they try to teach you to always sit if you can. But it did serve you so well, because throughout your career, throughout this memoir, you write beautifully about all the times when it seems like the outside pressure would be to get a test, do a CAT scan, you know, just accept at face value the information that you're given when a patient comes into your orbit. And again, you have the fundamental sense to say, well, now I'm going to go examine the patient. And I will admit, I'm probably a generation later than you in medical school. So I was never that confident in my own physical examination skills. I probably find myself in the camp of someone who thinks it is of relatively low value now that we have all of these technological tools. But just reading this, it kind of made me feel sad, I think, for myself and the, you know, the people that trained around me and the people that are getting trained nowadays. We just don't trust ourselves or our intuition at all.
I think there's two aspects to what you're just talking about, because you started that by saying, you know, the really quite large outpouring of support and interest that God's Hotel did, that was coming from something. And then you elided into the physical exam in specific. So I think, yes, both of those things. I think part of the outpouring is just a general kind of sense that what the physical exam represents and that way of being a doc that I'm expressing is a profession. It's this, a craft, right? I talk about, you know, when I realize the medicine isn't just a science, it's a craft, and it's an art. And I think it resonates because it's not just medicine that has been commodified, it's everything. And this soul, that sense of a craft, which I think the physical exam, so the second part about the physical exam is, I think our craft of medicine relies in part on that physical exam. And not so much, you know, Abraham Verghese talks about the physical exam as a ritual, which is fine with me. I mean, it is a ritual. But for me, it's an actual place where that's where the diagnoses are. They're not someplace else. The patient brings their body to us. And that's what's hurting. That's where the owie is. That's where the lymph nodes are. That's where the, right? It's there and it's right in front of you. So I think there's part of that outpouring is a sense of loss. Not just in medicine, but in everybody's life, this respect, really, too, for expertise, for experience. It's a lovely thing, right? In a gardener, in a plumber. I have a plumber who's has the craft of plumbing. He's just a pleasure to watch when he comes to the house because he's exactly like a doc. You know, he has a little bag, and he's so just so punctilious, and he examines. He'll just look for, he's like flow plumbing, right? He'll just look at the pipes. He won't touch it for a second. He'll just kind of look, and he'll kind of fuss, it's just a pleasure to watch him. So I think part of that longing is that that's lost. And in particular, with a physical exam, it's definitely being replaced by all those other things. Now, I can give you two great examples of where the technology is like way cool. And I teach medical students and physical exam. And a couple years ago, they brought in one of those otoscopes where you can, you know, they're not real otoscopes. They're like computerized things. You could see them on, you know, your iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Have you used them?
No, I haven't used them, but I've seen them.
Oh, it was amazing. And I really had to go like, wow, I got to say, this is way cool. As a technology that substitutes or replaces or complements whatever you want to use the physical exam. I had to really think like, okay, maybe that's what people will use. And is that bad? I had to say, no, it wasn't bad. So I'm kind of coming over to your side. I'll go back to the other side in a second. And then last year, they were trying to teach here at UCSF bedside ultrasound, right? Where they have those portable little ultrasound machines, and they came and they showed, and it was so cool. I just thought it was really cool. What I thought both of those things were most cool for, but particularly ultrasound, and I was teaching to students, I was saying, this is such a cool machine because you can learn your physical exam using this machine. You know, you can tap out the lungs and figure out where the fluid is, and then you can see if you're right, and vice versa. So those are two places where technology will completely replace the physical exam. Here's what I think would be lost. Isn't just the ritual part. It's like, for me, at this point in my career, even more than anything I touch, it's just being in the presence of the patient. And like my plumber, having those few minutes before I do anything. You know yourself, I'm sure, John, like the most important test we can take is like measuring the life force of this patient. That's kind of what I think. Sometimes when I teach my medical students, this is what I say, the really most important thing is, all you really have to answer, all you have to really be good at answering is this patient sick or not? Because if you're good at that, you're fantastic. Because if they're not really sick, you don't have to worry, right? You can just do a little bit, whatever. And if they're really sick and you jump on top of it, then you need to jump on top of it. So I think that there's even more the sense, just taking the temperature of the patient in some global way. And then the physical exam, I was lucky, and I was in all these places where getting a CT scan was really difficult. The patients had no money. They had no money. They couldn't afford it. Or I was in the countryside or in Nepal or at Laguna Honda, we had x-ray machine, but that's all we had. So if I wanted a CT scan, it was a big deal. So anything I could do with my hands and my eyes and my nose, my stethoscope was way good. So sometimes when the medical students, they kind of ask me, Dr. Sweet, we want to practice low medicine, but how can we do that? Is there any place left? I tell them to go to an Indian reservation or Africa or rural Virginia, West Virginia or someplace like that where they don't have access and they have to use this equipment.
So it's like they have to force themselves to rely on their own hands and skills, senses, as opposed to the technology. How many
right.
How many take you up on your advice?
I don't know. It's only been a couple of years, so took so few. But I think at least gives them a way. I think by saying that, and I also tell them as medical students, and they're in a hospital, what a great chance. If you do your physical exam, okay, so you're unsure of it. So you do it, and you listen to the heart, and you're not sure, but you really try, and you come up with your hypothesis about what the murmur is, and then the patient has his echo, and you learn something, right? You're actually in the ideal situation to get better at the physical exam.
Yeah, and too often we don't. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schoon. My guest today is Dr. Victoria Sweet, author of the new memoir, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. More than just a memoir, really. It's about really the practice of medicine. And it's a follow-up to her previous book, God's Hotel, which was her story of working at an almshouse, Laguna Honda Hospital, outside of San Francisco. And there's a couple of things in this new book, Slow Medicine, I wanted to ask you about. There's Dr. Greg's 30% solution, and I thought that was a pretty easy thing to kind of explain to our listeners and how that fits into the slow medicine philosophy. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us Dr. Greg's 30% solution?
Sure. So I was in the medical student, and it was on medicine, which at the time was sort of the most prestigious and the hardest clerkship. And it was my first real medical experience, really, after I'd learned the physical exam and learned how to go through a chart. And Dr. Greg was the attending, and that, you know, for your listeners, he was kind of the older, experienced doc who would show up on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays to walk around with us and kind of help us figure out what was wrong with the patient and give us his experience. He was a very interesting man, and so towards the end of my month on medicine, I asked him what advice he could give to me as a medical student who was going to become a doc, if he had any specific advice. And he was just getting into the elevator, and I remember it so clearly. He held the elevator door open, and he just said one thing. He said that in medicine, he said, we doctors think we are so important, but when you boil it down, the way it works is that a third of the patients get better, a third of them get worse, and a third of them get the same. And all we do with all our medications and technology is change who does what. And then he let the elevator door close, and I never saw him again, but I never forgot that. A third. Because I always ask myself, well, is it true? Is that true, that we only change who does what? And so ever after, for the last 40 years, I've always paid attention to the placebo arm of any study. And on the whole, it's shocking, but Dr. Greg is just about right, that if you add up the adverse reactions, the side effects of any medicine we give, and you compare that to a sugar pill we give the patient, you find that really for every heart attack we save using a statin, we cause suicide, homicide, or accidental death, and it all kind of balances out pretty much. Which isn't to say sometimes that the side effects and adverse reactions are worth it. But when you add it up, it's almost always that way. So that's what I call his 30% solution, because 33 1/3% would not have been as good a title. and I think in that regard, relative risk and how pernicious that concept is.
Oh, yes. I was going to ask you to explain that a little more. Relative risk versus absolute risk.
Yeah, it's how they've really, I got very confused for a while. I was really confused. So that it was a perfect example. I don't know how much detail you want me to get into at this point, but because there was just a study in the New England Journal which really struck me, which ends up being a study of how patients taking, I think it was rivaroxaban or whatever that is, with aspirin, is, you know, really causes, you know, fewer cardiovascular morbidity and mortality, but it's the relative risk was like 50%, but the actual difference was like 5.1% versus 4.3%. So that's the absolute risk. So what that means is the absolute risk for 100 patients is that if they take twice as much medications, they go from having 5 heart attacks to having 4 heart attacks. 5 people have a heart attack, 4 people. So one person actually in 100 people profits from taking these expensive medicines. But then if you look at in the adverse reactions and the side effects, the one other person who didn't have a heart attack, some one other person, extra one person, practically bled to death. So when you add that all up, it's kind of a wash. So I don't know if that...
Yeah, no, it sort of leads to that concept of therapeutic nihilism, sort of like darned if we do and darned if we don't. Well, there was only... The book is so rich and full of imagery, but one of the other few statistics you actually give is there's a story toward the end of the book about a Mrs. Persily, you call her, where you're working on a particular floor or ward, I guess, at Laguna Honda Hospital, and she has dementia, so she's not really able to communicate, and you go to great effort really because she develops clear pneumonia, and the kind of perfunctory knee jerk thing to do would be to send her to the hospital so she could get acute care, and you sort of make the point of, well, why are we doing this? What does she actually want, or had she ever discussed this? And so you painstakingly call all of her children. And there's a nurse, I guess, on the floor who's you know, doesn't want to deviate at all from protocol. But amazingly, you expect her to die. I mean, you expect her to kind of stay and...
Yeah, because, I mean, pneumonia, acute pneumonia, an old lady, untreated. I mean, of course she was going to die. I mean, I felt, it was so ironic because I felt, you know, I insist on getting advanced life directives from her daughter. Because I was being pushed. Actually, I didn't have to send her. We had an acute ward upstairs, so it wasn't like a major production, but it would be acute care, and I didn't know whether this demented old lady would have wanted all that care. So we called up her daughter, and it was because her daughter said, you know what, I think Mom wouldn't have wanted all the care, that I had the license. I just had the license to say, fine, and I assumed she would die of her pneumonia. Of course. So we didn't treat her, and I came in the next morning expecting her with this massive aspiration pneumonia to be way worse and maybe even dead. And I walk in, and she's not worse. She's actually a little better. So later on in the afternoon, I come back to see her again, and she's better still. And by the next morning, she was clearly on her way to recovery, and within a few days, she was fine. And the thing that got me about that was I had to laugh at myself, right, because I had thought I was doing this very bold thing to get advanced like directives and not treat because, of course, she would die of her pneumonia. But she didn't die of her pneumonia. And if I had treated her, if I'd sent her upstairs and given all the modern medicines we give people and she hadn't died, I would have thought, well, you got to admit it, modern technology is really great. But she hadn't needed modern technology. And that's when I remembered the statistic that William Osler gave, which is that before antibiotics, 25% of patients with pneumonia died. And that's a lot. But that meant, when I thought about it the other way, that 75% of patients with pneumonia survived, which meant, you know, something else had healed them. And that started getting me to think about how much of, not really therapeutic nihilism, I would say it's relying that about a third of the time you've got the patient's strength going for you, luck on your side, general health on your side, and that when we do add a medication, we're doing a pretty big thing, which I do think is another concept back to the physical exam that isn't very common anymore, to realize that medication, you know, pharmakon means poison in Greek, pharmacy, right?
Right.
The pharmakon, and we poison, that's the whole point of it, right? We try and poison the patient's system. Or we try and poison the bacteria in their system, and it right? But we're still releasing, we're doing something fundamentally different in their body. So I'm not a therapeutic nihilist, I don't think at all, but I am a therapeutic skeptic.
Skeptic, I like that better. I know we're almost out of time, but I can't let you go without asking you, the last chapter titled Slow Medicine Manifesto, what can conscientious practitioners do nowadays? There's so much burnout in the profession,
yeah.
So many doctors disaffected, wanting to get out. You yourself relate a story of an interesting sounding job working at a convent, caring for, I guess, retired nuns. But then when you walked into the kind of the central corridor, there was all just a computer room where all the providers, doctors and nurses, providers were typing away, and you thought, I'm not taking this job. So, you know, we all struggle with this to some extent. So is there, and I know I can't boil it down to a soundbite pithy solution, but you do advise the students to go and get worldly experience, which, you know, you did on your journey, what I called your odyssey. I mean, what can you leave us with? Or is it really just starting the conversation to kind of take back the profession? And
right. I think there's sort of a practical and theoretical. So I think one of them, I decided when I walked out of that job I was like, okay, well, I know I do not want to sit in front of a computer all the night. I won't do it. I refuse. Well, I'm lucky because I'm old enough that I can refuse and I can put my energy in really trying to, I mean, my mission, I figure my patient right now is like you guys, too. Our patient is the healthcare system, and making it possible for doctors to be, you know, scientists and craftsmen and artists the way we're supposed to be and have our personal relationship with the patients and do the things I'm talking about. And there has to be things that change. We have to get our time back to do that. So we get to do that, or maybe partially, and you have your radio show, and I'm doing what I'm doing. So I think it has to change. From a practical point of view, here's what's interesting. What I noticed, it's so ironic, is that who does have time to do the things we're talking about are the specialists. It's so ironic. Do you know that they, John, that they actually get 45 minutes with patients? I went with a friend who was being seen for an intermittent AFib, and so her primary care doc sent her to the cardiologist, and they went with her, and I'm sitting there going like, this guy is relaxed. This guy's examining her. I looked at my watch. He'd been there for like 40 minutes. He did an echo. He did an EKG. He chit-chatted about that. I was like, whoa. So it's pretty ironic that the specialists, I think, at some level are or could practice a lot more of what we're talking about because they have more time. So I hate to tell you this, but really, even though I love internal medicine, and I am so glad I'm an internist and didn't specialize, but if I were having to choose today, I probably would pick a specialty as long as that model stays in place. So that is a place, I think, where we still have some extra time. Now, they may narrow that, or the opposite may happen. I mean, in a way, it's kind of crazy. How come if I'm taking care of the whole body, I get 12 minutes? But if you're taking care of your eyes, gets 40 minutes. That doesn't make any sense. So one of the other things I've thought of was trying to get slow medicine. It seems ridiculous, but slow medicine be declared a specialty.
Yeah, I wanted to know more about that. How could you do that? How could we accomplish that?
Well, you know, they did it with palliative medicine. And, I mean, in a way, a lot of the stuff we're talking about is palliative. It's not palliative medicine at all, but it's some of the skills that palliative medicine uses. So they somehow got themselves a specialty. If slow medicine were a specialty, then we would get extra time. We would be able to act as consultants in the hospital. I mean, I think that'd be so useful for the generalist to go like, oh, my God, I do not know what to do with this person. You know, she's been back and forth. I know I'm missing something, but I just don't have the time to do it, to call the slow medicine consult. And we come in and we got 2 hours to really go through her chart, really physically examine her, go through everything and figure out what's wrong. So I do have this sort of iconoclastic idea, well, let's just make it a specialty then. There's a way to do it. They made hospitalists a specialty. They made palliative care a specialty. Why can't slow medicine be a specialty?
The name of the book is Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing, and it's by my guest today, Dr. Victoria Sweet, who is both a physician and a historian at the University of California, San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, John.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.